Okay, for this morning's talk, everyone's ready? Yes, I wanted to expand on some of the questions last night, and especially to address an issue which, when people first come to the retreat that I teach, can cause some confusion, and that is the place of effort in this practice of meditation. What actually is effort? Because this is central to the path of meditation. It's basically what you do or what you shouldn't do. And obviously it's nice to be able to learn these teachings, but you have to practice them. What does that actual practice entail? Should one be struggling and striving, or should you just be letting go? Should we just spend the whole retreat fast asleep, or should you be getting up early in the morning and struggling and striving and pushing? And what actually should you do, and why should you do that? So the talk this morning is going to be about on right effort. And for those of you who know your standard Buddhism, that right effort is one of the factors of the Eightfold Path. And these days I like to adapt those old translations. For any of you who want to know the history of the English version of the teachings of the Buddha, much of those early translations were done by Professor Rice Davids, who did a very excellent job considering just the lack of materials and support which he had. But nevertheless, there's a few of those words which he coined that don't really portray accurately the meaning of the Pali. And the idea of right, it means there must be a wrong. It's almost like a value judgment there. And these days, instead of right effort, I much prefer the word like skillful effort. In other words, it's appropriate for the goal in mind. So if you're going to work, there's a certain type of effort you need. And it's not the same as the effort required if you're doing meditation. It's the effort is dependent upon the goal, what you want to achieve. So I prefer the word skillful effort rather than right effort. In other words, it's skillful for the task of calming the mind, bringing up mindfulness, developing insight, and liberating the mind from the delusion which causes rebirth. In other words, the effort which leads to enlightenment. And basically what the Buddha said is whatever it takes to produce wholesome, good states of mind. Now, in the context of just making good karma, that's one type of effort. In the context of becoming liberated, by developing meditation, that's a far more subtle effort is required. So we have to first of all distinguish the different types of effort which are contingent on the type of goal we want to achieve. Now, during this meditation retreat, at the very beginning, I mentioned the word stillness. And just on the subject of the translations of these Pali terms, the eighth factor of that Eightfold Path, skillful samadhi, that word samadhi is, again, by Professor Rice Davids, was translated as concentration. And that's not a bad translation for someone working 120 years ago. But these days it just doesn't really match the experience of what happens when you achieve samadhi. Instead of concentration, I much prefer the word stillness. Because when we talk about the meditation of being a still mind, not only does it describe more accurately the experience of deep meditation, where everything is just so still, nothing is moving. That's where we get the word concentration. It's one-pointed, it doesn't move, there's no diversity because of nothing moves. But a much better word is stillness. And the reason why I prefer the word stillness, because when you take stillness as a goal, then you can contemplate, how do I achieve stillness? And it's very clear, if stillness is a goal, anything which agitates the mind is counterproductive. You can't create stillness by agitating things. And you all know the best way to create stillness is by leaving things alone, butting out, not doing things. Concentration, on the other hand, implies some effort. And it implies like struggling to hold something and keep it hold and fend off all of the distractions and just keep your mind on one thing with effort. And that's why that sometimes the concentration even has the implications on modern society of concentration camps. And if we were doing a lot of samadhi, that type of forceful samadhi here, then this retreat center would be a concentration camp. It's a camp. You're sitting here, and it will be developing concentration. So you could go back home to England or Singapore or Penang and say, I went to Ajahn Brahm's concentration camp. It wouldn't go down very well with your friends. But concentration, even at school, you were told to concentrate, which meant put forth more effort. And the problem is that when one tries to concentrate, one gets very tense. And that's what would happen to you maybe at school. You'd be trying, you get so tense that usually you'd fail. When people try to concentrate at an examination, or they try to concentrate when they are playing, say, a game of tennis, the very force of concentrating usually makes one very tense. One cannot really adapt to the situations as they change. One has a fixed plan, and one is actually not all that mindful. One gets tense, one fails, one gets stressed, one gets disappointed. And there's a good reason for that. If you really look at what their concentration, which is coming out of control, is concerned, if you look deeper, you find that it can never really achieve its aim. You can't really concentrate through force. And the standard description of that, which is why I filled my cup with water first of all, many of you see me do this many times, but it's a very accurate description which brings out the reason why concentration through force can never give you any sense of peace, relaxation or stillness. It's a simile of the cup of water. Now I'm going to hold the cup of water still. I'm going to concentrate. Be mindful, concentrate to hold this cup of water still. I know you've seen me do this before down here, but you're the closest. I want you to be absolutely honest here. Is this water still?
No.
Okay, don't go too far, because I'm going to try harder. I'm going to focus. Okay, I'm really going to hold it hard. Now, I think that all of you will know this. You can go back now. All of you will know this. You can try it yourself. There is no way in the world, with all the training I could train day after day all my life, I would never be able to hold this cup of water in the hand absolutely still. If there's any person who's done medicine before, or just human biology, you know the nature of muscles in the arm, they're always having to metabolize, which means they're always moving, there's always some agitation in the arm. There's no way I can hold this cup of water absolutely still. Now this is why many people put effort into meditation, to hold their mind still. Come on, stop thinking. Hold it on the breath. Hold it in this moment, or whatever else you do. And you find not only do you get tense, you start to ache, but also you can't achieve it. Now the beauty of this simile is because there's a very easy way to have the water still. Now you have to come closer down here again. Now I'm holding it still. Is it still yet?
No, it's moving.
Okay, don't go anywhere. So I just put it down. Is it moving more or less?
Very much.
Very much. That's what happens when you let go. It moves more and more. It looks like you're being more agitated. That is par for the course. When you start letting go in meditation, letting go of the effort, the restlessness, the stop and torpor get more at the beginning. But now, is it moving?
It's still.
It's still. Thank you. I'll give you the bribe after the retreat is finished. All magicians, have their female accomplices. I should have got you come on in a skimpy dress or something. And here's my... this is a retreat, this is not a show. But now that, what happened there? Because I let go and put it down and rested it. First of all, it moved more. But then it stopped moving. Why did it stop moving? Because there was nothing left to agitate it. The cause of agitation had been removed. It's put down on something stable. It becomes still all by itself. Now this is a powerful simile for what happens in meditation. The more one tries to hold the mind, or hold mindfulness, to create mindfulness, you find the less mindfulness you will truly have. Through force, through controlling, you can get so far. As I mentioned, I think, yesterday or last night, if you really want to hold the breath with force, you can watch the breath with force. But it only gets so still. It can never reach the type of stillness when you let things go and put it down. Which means the right effort, or rather skillful effort, the effort which creates the stillness of the mind, is the effort which can put things down, which can let things go, which can separate, detach from things, which doesn't crave, which doesn't criticize, which doesn't sort of try and interfere with things, which can stand back with equanimity, with non-involvement, and just watch and wait and don't get to interfere. The trouble is that sometimes we put the cup down and then we're getting still. Is it still? We go pick it up again and we sort of start to agitate it. So the real right effort is actually an effort to stop, an effort to let go, an effort to guard, an effort to just to see, just the way the mind just starts to get involved in things at certain stages of the meditation. In practice, the type of effort of letting go is very hard to do. Number one, it does go against the grain. We're not used to just sitting down and doing nothing. And sometimes it is counterintuitive, as I said. More of the time in our life, if we want to achieve anything worthwhile, we've had to strive and work for it. There's no such thing as a free lunch, except enlightenment is a free lunch. It just comes when we're not doing anything. However, because it's counterintuitive, sometimes we need a little bit of faith, a little bit of experience, a little bit of trial and error to see what happens. Which is why that sometimes in a whole retreat of 9 days, sometimes only once will you let go enough to experience a still mind, or at least a reasonably still mind. And that's really important, to give you the experience to see what is going on. Because if you do that once, that will show you the truth of this. The experience which goes against, you know, your standard beliefs and accepted ideas. Just one really good experience just blows away all those ideas and theories, and you start to see the nature of things as they truly are. Yeah, I did let go, and yeah, the mind became so still. All this stuff actually works. Which is why that I said last night, just one very deep meditation, and I've done my job, and you've had a very, very, very successful retreat. You understand how this whole process works. In theory, you can't grab it. It doesn't make sense sometimes. But in practice, it does. There are a few similes, like the cup of water, which gives you an idea why it makes sense. So I just want you to let go once. Let go enough to see that that is the way of stillness. Not only that, but to see that way of stillness, of calming the mind down, stilling the mind, that also gives you an insight into this wonderful thing called mindfulness. And what actually is mindfulness? Yes, an awareness, but all the different levels of awareness. And this is why, because of the way that I was taught meditation and just the way I've been practicing all these years, you understand that the mindfulness has so many different levels of intensity and depth and power. Which is why that, you know, I coined the words power mindfulness and superpower mindfulness. To make it quite clear that mindfulness isn't just mindfulness, it's not all the same. There are some mindfulnesses which are weak, some which are average, and some which are powerful, and some which are super powerful, almost out of this world. And also, you'll notice in some of your meditations here, that there are times when you're very clear, very powerful, whatever you can see deeply, and you see lots of detail, and it's very beautiful, the colours are richer than usual. Those are signs that your mindfulness is getting really strong. Usually, retreats such as this, they go out into the garden and they just see like a piece of bark on the ground there. And they look at that for an hour. Just a tiny piece of bark. They're, wow, look at that. It's amazing just what they see in that. My classic story, after my second year, I think, at Cambridge. The first year I was meditating, I sort of got into it, but not all that much. But the second year I really got into it. And so as a retreat at the end of the year, I can give it a date, 1971. It was amazing. I was just, you know, had a nice girlfriend and was sleeping with her. And just, I said goodbye to my girlfriend. I was going on a retreat for 9 days. So, you know, it's amazing just to get into deep meditations, even though that, you know, you were being quite sensual at the time. But anyway, I went on the retreat. And I got some very, very nice meditations on that retreat. And we were allowed every morning, I think it was before breakfast, you know, because it was summertime, so the sun was up really early in England. And so, you know, the sun was up about 4 or 5 o'clock. So we could go for a walk between 6 and 7, you know, before the breakfast started. And I remember that because I knew Cambridge, been a student there for 2 years, not far away from the retreat centre, which was in a boarding house, actually 3 boarding houses we rented, not far away was the botanical garden. If you're going to go for a walk, you know, might as well go for a walk somewhere pleasant. So I went to the botanical gardens and I thought I'd have a nice walk, you know, down the botanical gardens to the end of Bateman Street. But as soon as I went into those botanical gardens, I went through the gate, and I can still visualize it now. On the right-hand side, there was a clump of bamboo. And, you know, it's amazing. That was the most beautiful clump of bamboo I'd ever seen in my whole life. Not just a clump of bamboo, it's the most beautiful trees. I don't know if you've ever seen these Chinese watercolors. And they always tend to have, like, bamboo in these watercolors. Because, like, the bamboo is just, like, tall and slender, and just its proportions and shape and the subtle colours, it was like I was just seeing one of the most amazing Chinese watercolours, but in real life. And I was just looking at that clump of bamboo, and there was a slight breeze, so it was just waving slightly in the breeze, and it was almost like dancing, like some opera or some sort of ballet. And I was entranced. Like, I just could not move away from that clump of bamboo. And I did feel a bit self-conscious, you know, the young guy staring at this clump of bamboo in a public area. So a thought came into my mind. I noticed there was a bench close by, so I went down and sat in that bench and spent the next 50 minutes just staring, gaping at this amazing clump of bamboo. And, you know, I was a young man, so I liked my food, and so it was only the promise of breakfast which drew me away. And I promised I'd go there the next morning. Out of that 9-day retreat, 8 of those mornings, I went to the same place, sat on that, I was supposed to be exercising, but sat on the bench and just gazed at just a small clump of bamboo. And I used to call it the most beautiful clump of bamboo in the whole world. It was amazing. It was incredibly beautiful. Then the retreat finished. Actually, the ninth day, I went to a walk down the river. I thought I'd just try something else. After the retreat had finished, it was back to the studies. And, you know, very busy. But I had a free afternoon one day, and I thought, what should I go and see my most beautiful clump of bamboo? I had such a wonderful time there. So I got on my bicycle, as you did at Cambridge as a student, you know, just negotiated the very busy traffic, you know, with all the horns going and the red lights, and found my way to the Botanical Gardens, parked the bike, and with great expectations, I went inside and saw this miserable, dirty, sort of dry, desiccated sort of clump of bamboo. I was actually shocked. Where's my beautiful bamboo gone? I realised it was exactly the same clump of bamboo. The bamboo hadn't changed, but my mind had changed. I'd lost my power for mindfulness. I'd been busy, active, doing things. And as if the power of the mind had all just gone down. And now I saw just the way that most people see clumps of bamboo. Remember, this is England, it's not the right climate for bamboo. With the best gardeners in the world, they can't make it lush and verdant. But when my mind was very clear, that's what it looked like. Now that was a sign of many experiences, which I've had, many other people have had, of powerful mindfulness. And I mentioned this carpet, this is an industrial carpet. This has been here ever since we started coming here, this dirty old, cheapo carpet. But one thing might happen to you, you might be meditating, get into a very deep state of meditation, and you open your eyes, wow, look at that. Oh, Look at all the greens and the blues, and there's even oranges in there. You can just see the way it's textured. It's like a range of mountains. You need to get into it. And sometimes people think they're going crazy. Not going crazy. This is what happens with powerful mindfulness. So how do you get mindful? If you try and force the mindfulness, yeah, you can pay attention on this and attention on that, just like you did at school. But the power never generates. You can see, but you never see deeply to penetrate. The penetrating mindfulness, the power of it always comes from stillness. And this is where I introduce one of those frameworks for understanding which helps the whole path of meditation and also enlightenment as well. And this is, you know, the doer and the knower, which I promised I'd talk more about. I use the words doer and knower. You know, in Pali, it will be Chaitana, sometimes Sankara, and Vijnana, consciousness. So this is not just an invention of Ajahn Brahm. This is actually in the suttas as well. I can point it out to you later on if you want to find it, if I can remember where it was. The doer and the knower is a very helpful framework from understanding the mind and understanding how meditation works. And again, as I mentioned last night, the doer is the active part of the mind. That which thinks, which assesses, which reacts, what causes you to scratch or to move or to decide anything. The active part of your mind, the doer. The knower is just what receives the information, what is hearing, what I'm saying, what can see me, what can feel the body, but it doesn't react at all, it doesn't do anything, it just knows, itch, it just knows it's aching, it just knows it's hot or it's cold, but it doesn't react. It's the passive part of the mind. And that really is what the Buddha called consciousness, Vijnana. Either sort of the sight consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, taste consciousness, body consciousness, it knows what's happening. Or mind consciousness, it understands, realizes what's occurring. The reacting mind, okay, now what are you going to do about that? What causes the mind to move and do something, that's the doing mind. So you can see, I mean, you're experiencing the breath. You watch the breath going in. Now, do you react to that? Do you say, oh, it's not peaceful enough, I've got to do this, or I'm too dull? You know, you notice yourself sleepy. You're conscious, you're tired. What do you do about that? Do you struggle, do you let go, whatever? That's the active part of the mind which decides what to do next, and does it. Now, when you get your head around that framework, the doer and the knower, one important part to understand the physics and nature of the mind. For a body to be healthy, to be strong, you have to exercise it. For a mind to be strong, you have to keep it still. So Ajahn Chah kept on saying, and again, you found those sayings in the Buddhist teachings as well. If you want a very healthy, strong and powerful mind, exercising it just weakens it. You have to keep it still. In other words, suppress the doer. Suppress the reactive force of the mind. Because every time your mind moves and chooses and does something, it wastes energy. The energy of the mind just dissipates. You know that. That's why many of you are tired. We call that stress. But it's not so much stress of the body, it's the tiredness of the mind. The deep tiredness because you're having to work and do so much. And I have to do a lot as a monk. That's why I was tired the first couple of days of this retreat. My energy's coming up now, because I know how to keep my mind still. And you'll notice, during this retreat, the talks which I give, first couple of talks, they'll be just ordinary. When you get really into the retreat, they become powerful, simply because my energies start to increase. Simply because of stillness. You'll notice, the more still you are, the more energy your mind has. And that's translated as powerful mindfulness. There will be times in your meditation you get very still. You can watch the breath and nothing is disturbing you. Nothing is moving. You're settled. When you come out afterwards, that's when you see the incredible carpets. As you look at the bricks, that's where sometimes you can even smell these incredibly sweet scents. Is it Deva scents or whatever is it? Doesn't matter, but your nose is so sensitive, it can smell things so deeply. Your mindfulness is increasing. And it's not just the mindfulness which is increasing. Because of the energy which is getting into your mind, not only are you awakened up, and you've got incredible mindfulness, you're just a happy little meditator. The energy of the mind is happiness. That's Piti's stuka. That's the joy of meditation. You don't really get the joy of meditation by listening to one of my jokes. You just get grown and fed up. And that carrot joke yesterday was terrible. But it doesn't matter. It is the joy which comes up from the stillness of the mind. That is the one which we delight in. So we're delighting in stillness. And we're delighting in the consequence of stillness, which is the joy, the happiness. So when you understand how it works, every time you react and do something, you're actually weakening your mindfulness. And you are stopping the joy building up. Which is why that sometimes people put a lot of effort and they get frustrated and miserable. Our job, if you understand this way of meditation, is to observe but not react. To be what in Buddhism we call the silent observer. To watch and don't do anything. No matter what it is, tiredness, sleepiness, whether it's a restless mind, whether it's a crazy mind. What's wrong with being crazy? Leave it alone. Let it be. Don't react. Don't fight. Don't indulge. And you'll find, because you're still, because there's no moving of the mind into likes or dislikes, you'll find, because of that stillness, your mindfulness gets stronger, the joy gets stronger, and your meditation gets easier and deeper. So the right effort is actually, first of all, seeing this jhana, this will, this disturbing controller which keeps on stopping you meditating. To see how you control things and how you manage things, how you judge, how you want, how you decide whether this is a good meditation or a bad meditation or whatever. How you control things. And notice that is a problem. That is what stops meditation working. That's what actually stops you getting energized, deep, mindful, and also stops you becoming enlightened. The controller. It takes guts to let go of control. Because sometimes it feels like you're driving along the freeway in busy traffic and Ajahn Brahm asks you to take your hands off the steering wheel. And think, I can't do this, I'm going to crash. And that's what many of you feel. Ah, if I don't put effort, I'm going to fall asleep. I'm going to spend the rest of this retreat just in bed. I'm not even going to get up at all. I'm going to completely waste my time. I paid a lot of money for this retreat. And you're telling me just to waste it all just by sleeping and doing nothing. Try it. See what happens. If you do it properly, if you take your hands off the steering wheel and your feet off the pedals, you find the car doesn't crash. You find that your meditation just really starts to take off. You really are learning how to put your cup down and just watch this whole process of stillness happen. Because you're not doing anything, there's nothing left to disturb this mind, and it gets more and more and more still. And you're just this passenger, just watching with amazement what it's like to have a still mind. And how just incredibly easy it is to watch the breath. You don't force the mind onto the breath anymore. Because you're still, it just stays with the breath. And at last you say, ah, now I understand what meditation is all about. It wasn't the breath's fault. It was just me, I kept on messing around with it. No wonder it got disturbed. You just stand back and you watch. The stillness. No reacting. Long breath, a short breath, a tired breath, a disturbed breath. You know another word for this? The stillness is called loving kindness. When we talk about loving kindness, what is the most important word with loving kindness in Buddhism? Unconditional, indiscriminate loving kindness. Which means whatever you see, you love them, you have metta towards them, no matter who they are, no matter what they're doing. No judging, no reacting. That type of loving kindness is an embracing. Embracing this moment, not saying it should be better, it could be worse, but allowing it to be completely as it is. That's the expression of loving kindness. If you have metta towards someone, you don't have metta towards them because they're nice and they say that you're a great monk. You have metta towards, you know, other people, even if they say you stink. Or, you know, you're the most stupid monk I've ever met in my whole life. You have loving kindness to them, you treat them the same. In other words, it's unconditional. The same way that if we can look at our meditation object at this moment, whatever we're observing, with that degree of loving kindness, you can see it doesn't react. It doesn't control, it doesn't try and change things. It allows things to be as they already are. The non-reactive essence of loving kindness. Accepting rather than changing. If we can do this, now we find that everything becomes still. But the danger of such stillness is that it's going to challenge some of your deepest attachments. I mentioned yesterday, when you really let go, you become dispensable. You become not the center of the universe anymore. And that is a huge challenge to a person's ego. The more we control, the more we are. When we give up control, we disappear. Now that is the problem. Which is why, especially Western people, are control freaks. We don't think we are, but you are a control freak. Which means that you can't let things go. Especially in meditation. Stop controlling it. I can't. Why is that? You have all these excuses. You think it's going to go wrong. It's not going to work. That's an excuse. The real reason is you don't feel comfortable with letting go. And the reason you don't feel comfortable with letting go, it challenges your deepest attachment. The attachment to your sense of who you are. Who are you anyway? Sometimes people say, I'm an engineer. I'm a bridge player. I'm I don't know what else other people are here. I'm an accountant. I'm an IT expert. I'm a bookkeeper. I'm a lawyer. Is that really who you are? Is that what you've made yourself be? A lot of times, we are what we have created for ourselves. And when I say stop creating things, it's as if you have to disappear. And you've come so far in your life with all this creating and controlling. And here you are, a successful, healthy, reasonably, you know, middle-aged human being. Or, I've been quite sort of kind, old-age human being. And here you are. Now I'm telling you, you've just been wasting all those years. How about stopping? And don't create anything. And allow yourself, your ego, who you define yourself to be, to completely vanish. Because that's what happens with when we control. When we stop controlling, we disappear. That's why it's so hard to do. That's why at each stage of this meditation, the deeper you go, the more it challenges your identity. That's why the teachings of non-self go hand in hand with the path of stillness. The more you are, the less still you are. As you disappear, you get calmer and calmer. When you completely vanish, then there's only stillness left. That's a great description of what meditation is like as an experience. So So you start your meditation, just sitting down. And you think, wow, this is going to enhance my ability to perform my career. It's going to make me healthier. It's going to make me happier. It's going to make me more spiritual. Whatever ego things you start off with by coming to a meditation retreat, little by little, all those get laid aside as you go deeper. As far as effort is concerned, at the beginning, the effort doesn't disturb that much. It is still counterproductive, but it's not so dangerous. So a person who does begin the meditation, they put forth effort, they want to watch the breath and they hold the mind still on the breath. If you really want to waste time and do that, okay, go and do that. I don't mind, but please give up pretty quickly. Once you've got the breath in mind, let go. The deeper you go in meditation, the more crucial it is for further progress or further ingress to let go of control more and more. No matter how you've been meditating before, there has to come a time. If you really want to get into the real meditations, where you just have to completely let go. The deeper you are, the more important that is. And even if you think you're letting go, sometimes if you come to a blockage in meditation, you can't go any further. It always is the case that you won't allow yourself to go further, because you're too scared to let go of that little bit more. That's why, and the very threshold of the jhanas, this is straight from the Upakalesa Sutta of the Buddha, the two of the most important, or rather, two of the most difficult obstacles to overcome are fear and excitement. When you get so close to the jhanas, the excitement is the fact, wow, at last! You know, the incredible power, bliss, stillness. And that excitement, as many of you may experience that, it's working! You've blown it, stupid. Don't get excited. It's supposed to be stillness. You got so far, you almost got the prize. And when you got the prize, you've blown it at the last moment, stupid. I've done that many times, so I know. I'm calling myself stupid. And then sometimes you get incredible, powerful impetus. Wow! And then it goes away again. But more than that is the fear. And that fear is just a powerful, it's amazing to behold. You know it's going to be wonderful. You know that this is really what you've been, no, I was going to say working towards. This is what you've been skillfully letting go towards. And there it's for you, but you don't want to just go that last little piece. And it's not so much what that nun said, which I was someone asked a question about last night. I don't deserve this. It's just, I'm too afraid. I have to let go of something far too personal to make that final step into the jhana. And it's true. Those of you, those people who have been into those jhanas, what you're letting go of is your last vestige of control of the doer. The whole path into stillness is a subjugation, suppression, letting go, calming down, stilling of this doer. And with it goes you. So when you're into those jhanas, basically the experience inside is you don't exist anymore. You've gone. That's what it sometimes feels like. So much so that in history, when Hindus or some Christian mystics attain those jhanas, they call them union with God, or just a oneness with the Paramatman, or Mahabrahma, whatever you wish to call it in Hinduism. And you can understand why they experience it like that, because they had an absence of their sense of self. Themselves as they knew it completely disappeared, and they left an incredibly powerful consciousness. So powerful that people call that type of bliss, the only word they have is the bliss of incredible, powerful love, joy, oneness. And of course, if you've been brought up believing in a God, that's what you would identify that experience with. That's why they say this union with God. When you get into those jhanas, you can understand why they say that. It's not union with God. There's no such thing as a God. You can go far deeper than that. But that's a good start for understanding the selflessness of those states. So when you are letting go, when you're not reacting, when you're not doing anything, it's a tough ask, because I'm also asking you to disappear. For your ego, for yourself, everything which you think you are, to put that aside. The less ego you have, the easier meditation becomes. Remember, I think Sharon Salzberg, I got this, I think, from Joseph Goldstein. I went to visit him a couple of years ago. Now, and Sharon Salzberg, she wrote a book on loving kindness meditation. And that was actually picked up by Oprah Winfrey. And she liked the book, and so she actually invited Sharon Salzberg on the Oprah Winfrey show. And of course, you know, that made her quite famous for a few days. And sold a lot of copies of her book. And afterwards, Sharon Salzberg, this is a meditator, sort of talking with Oprah Winfrey, and Oprah said, well, I've got a big mansion, why didn't you hold a weekend meditation retreat at my mansion? So Oprah Winfrey sort of began a weekend meditation retreat at her mansion, I think it's outside of Chicago, Illinois somewhere, I'm not sure where it is, where they're led by Sharon Salzberg. And Oprah Winfrey lasted about half an hour before she ran out of her house. So I was told anyway. Because she's such a control freak, she can't let go at all. No peace at all there. Very successful in the world, and huge ego, Oprah Winfrey. But the bigger the ego, the harder it is to be still. You look at powerful people in this world, and how many of them can actually just sit down still for an hour. Can't do it. The ego creates the agitation, which prevents them being still. This is why this is not just for stillness, it's for understanding what this ego truly is, and how to let it go, and how to disappear, and how to have incredible joy when you're not there. Part of stillness is also the power of incredible insight. It comes at the same time you understand what these attachments are, because these are the things which stop you getting to the next stage. Me, I'm the problem, I'm the attachment. Let that go and everything becomes so easy. So your effort is actually to follow this path of path is, but no traveller on it is seen. Nibbana is, but you have to disappear to enter it. The ego, the self, the me, the controller. Later on, I'll talk more about this knower. Because in the jhana, that's the thing which is left. And remember, there's many jhanas. And the whole purpose of going through the jhana, first, second, third, fourth, and the immaterial ones, is to watch this knower fade away. See that go as well. And go into deeper and deeper states of bliss and peace and stillness, of ecstasy and incredible, powerful insights. These aren't insights born of inference or thinking. These are insights born of raw experience, of seeing the dissolution of the sense of self through stillness. Doesn't matter how still you are, you can always be more still. So in this meditation, whenever you get to a deep stage and think, what should I do next? Again, next, wrong question. Just be more still. Be more still. Be more still. Control disappears. You know public enemy number one in Buddhism? Public enemy number one in Buddhism is this guy called Mara. Not just a man, because he's got his daughters. He's got Mara's daughters as well, so it goes across the genders. And Mara, it's like the devil in sort of Christianity. So sometimes people ask, isn't there such a thing as a devil? Well, sort of, but this guy's not evil. He's just the control freak in chief of the universe. That's what Mara is. And I've got good reason to say that, because Mara, in Buddhist cosmology, you know, in all the different realms of existence, Mara is the chief of this realm, just below the jhana realms, interestingly, below the Brahma Loka. He's the chief of the devas, the angels, in the Paranimitta Vasavati realm. Paranimitta Vasavati means those who wield power over other people's creations. The wield of the power, the controllers of other people. These are the control freaks. Control freak in chief is Mara. They're not like evil. He just wants to control everybody, and he doesn't want anyone being free from controlling. When I understand why the Buddha called Mara just, you know, the tempter, sometimes he called him, tempting you, come on, just put a little bit of effort in your meditation, it'll work, come on, come on, come on, just try a little bit more, come on, come on, come on, that's Mara speaking. Just let go. And that completely confounds Mara. And after you get beyond that realm into the jhana realms and the Brahma Loka, that is where, according to the text, you have blindfolded Mara. Mara can't find you. You've gone to where Mara can't come. In the jhanas, control is gone, because will has vanished. This is what stillness means. So, the effort which you should be putting forth in this meditation is actually a letting go effort. But be careful, what are you letting go of? And again, Buddhists sometimes get confused in this. One of the people who comes to Nolamara, he was keeping 5 precepts, and he went to a reception for his business, some sort of business party, and someone offered him a drink, some alcohol, and I have some alcohol. He said, no, I can't take alcohol, I'm a Buddhist. Now these days, people know a little bit about Buddhism in Australia. So the fellow handing him the drink said, yeah, Buddhist, I know about Buddhism, let go. Come on, let go, have some alcohol for goodness sake. And he told me that story. He said, oh, Christ. Yeah, letting go, but it's not letting go of that. Not letting go of your precepts. That's not what we mean by letting go. You've got to let go of the right thing, for goodness sake. And in this retreat, it doesn't mean letting go and, I'm just going to eat as much as I want, I'm going to just sleep as much as I want, I'm going to really indulge. That's not what I mean by letting go. So this is sometimes people get confused. Am I just supposed to sleep, eat in this retreat? Is that what Ajahn Brahm means by letting go? No. What you should be letting go of is the controller. That which wants to sleep more. Or that which wants to sleep less. That which wants to eat more or eat less. That controller inside, that's what you let go of. So when you let go of the controller inside of you, the driver of your car, you become much more natural, much more automatic. You're tired, you sleep. You wake up, you just get up. No matter what time of the night it is. When it's time to eat, you eat. Sometimes you don't feel like eating much, sometimes you feel like eating more. But it's not coming from craving anymore, not coming from controlling, not coming from doing. So you're letting go of that doer and that controller. And when you're meditating, sitting down, you look and see what's happening, put some attention on that doer. Understand what I mean by that doer. That which causes movement in the mind, which causes agitation. That which when you're meditating, you think, I want to get up now. Why? Where did that come from? Or which says, now I've got to go in the bed. Now I've got to do the loving kindness meditation. Now I'll do some other type of meditation. That movement there, that's what we want to sort of look at and be so mindful of. You can see it. Be quiet. Calm down. Shh. So we suppress that controller and give ourselves some freedom, some peace, some stillness. We've got to see what we're holding on to. And to see how we can just put it down. You know when you've done it correctly, because when you do put down a cup of water, you expect it's going to move more, first of all. Par for the course, leave it alone, don't worry about it. When you think, it's not working, it doesn't work immediately. It takes a little bit of time for the causes and conditions to bring forth their results. You plant a mango, it takes years before you get a mango tree. And a mango on the end of that tree. Meditation is much faster, but still, it's not immediate. Let it go and wait. Patience. And soon, things start to go very still and calm and peaceful. I've been teaching this for many years, been practicing it for many years. I had one of the greatest teachers with an Ajahn Chah. He would always just say in this, he pick up, I remember this, I told it at Nodamara a couple of weeks ago, because in January I went over to the meeting, an annual meeting on the death anniversary of Ajahn Chah in northeast Thailand. I was summoned to go over there. So I went over there, you know, to help Ajahn Sumedho with a bit of a difficulty. So I went over there, and because a lot of my monks, because we're all good friends, and they were teasing me that I put on weight. And I said, oh, I'm very fit. Nah, you're just overweight. So while all these other senior monks, they got in the car to do this 6 kilometer journey from Wat Nanachat to Wat Bapong, I said, I'm going to walk, I'm going to show you guys. And Ajahn Yanadama, who many of you know, he said, if Ajahn Brahm walks, we're never going to hear the end of this. And he was right. I kept on reminding him again and again, you're a lazy monk. I might be fatter than you, but at least I'm fitter than you. We're only teasing each other. But anyway, when I went on the walk from Wat Nanachat, you know, I passed where I used to go on alms round with Ajahn Chah. And, you know, it's like nostalgia. You know, when you go back and you remember all these 9 years, you know, you're in this monastery and all the places and the events which happened in those early years. And I remember the place. And I told them, right, exactly this is the spot where Ajahn Chah, he picked up this stick and turned around. He did this to a couple of monks. He picked up the stick, which was lying on the path, and said, is this stick heavy? And before I had a chance to answer it, he threw it away. So it's only heavy when you grasp it. When you hold it, that's the only time it's heavy. Understand? He says, meditation's only heavy. It's only a problem when you're holding something. When you let things go and put things down, what's the problem with meditation? What's the difficulty? How can you ever say that meditation is hard? It's only hard when you keep holding on to something. So if you ever have any problem with your meditation, if it's difficult, it's not working, you're holding on to something, please notice what you're holding on to and chuck it away. Put down the cup, stop controlling, grasping, craving, attaching. And then you find this meditation is the easiest thing in the world to do. So peaceful, so wonderful, so joyful, so insightful. You get the biggest insights you can ever handle of enlightenment itself. I remember sometimes in the reading, this was in the Therigata, the verses of the enlightened nuns. Some of these nuns, these were bhikkhunis in the time of the Buddha, just incredibly highly motivated, gave up their whole lives, and it was much harder to become a bhikkhuni than to become a monk. They gave up their whole lives, were practicing Dharma and getting nowhere. And all these enlightened nuns, one after the other, I remember reading him. He said, oh no, my meditation was getting nowhere until this great teacher came and taught me the real meditation. Within a few days I was completely enlightened. One after the other, once you get the message of how it's done, all the problems disappear and becomes very easy, and enlightenment happens, even to you. And that teacher was actually Patachara, this incredibly powerful, wise, amazing teacher nun. Sometimes just get the right teachings, and where was the difficulty? It's only because I didn't really know what I was up to, what I was doing. Your message comes, the light bulb goes on. Let go. You know what to let go of. You don't let go of the breath, you don't let go of this, you let go of that being inside who's always trying to control and hold on to things. That's what we let go of. The grasper, the controller. We let go of the doer. That is what right effort is. Skillful effort. Yeah, it sounds like a non-doing. And that's pretty close. But because we've started off with doing things, it takes a little bit of effort to stop the doing. Mindfulness, guards on the mind, so you don't do anything. And then everything stops. And meditation becomes, ooh, that was nice. And so effortless. So that is skillful. Skillful, effort, less. So, any comments or questions about that? Yeah. Restlessness. my cup is now restless. It's moving up and down. It's a result of old karma, because I grasped it, because I got hold of it, because I moved it. Restlessness is a result of old karma. It's here. So you can't sort of suddenly wave a wand or suppress it and stop, I'm going to stop my restlessness. You're making more karma. You are creating more restlessness now by reacting to the restlessness. So you're creating more restlessness in the future by reacting to the restlessness now. So it's here. It's come. You've got to just cop it sweet, as I used to say. Allow it to be. It's here. What can you do about it? You can't get rid of it, but you can make sure you're not creating more causes for restlessness in the future. You're not doing anything about it. Yeah, I'm restless. It's not against the precepts. Not against my Patimokkha rules. I'm restless. I'm just going to be here. With my restlessness. Without reacting to it. I'm not going to think, you stupid Ajahn Brahm. All these years as a monk and you're restless again. That's ego again. And that's creating conflict. And that's creating this stress in the mind. Business to be done. So I just restless, leave it alone. When you leave it alone, it's amazing how fast it stops. Yeah, it's restless a little bit more for a while. But of course you'll let it go. You watch that restless mind. Don't do anything. Now it's stopped. As quick as that. When you let things go. It's like turning off the gas of a car. See the petrol switch, you just turn it off. So there's no fuel creating the restlessness anymore. And that fuel is you. You're doing it. And anyone ever says they're meditating and thoughts that just come from nowhere. Yeah, sure, I don't believe that. Because I know it's wrong. If a thought comes into your mind, you bring it in. Don't think it's not your fault. You have been bored, you've gone outside looking for a thought. Something to disturb you and distract you. That's the nature of it. If you really let go, thoughts just can't come. Yes, John, I saw your face there, about to come up with a question. Okay, yeah. Okay, one of the problems is that it's not you can't be, but most people find it difficult to find sort of contentment and happiness in the present moment. So how do you make it sort of become happy? And because if you're not happy in the present moment, then thoughts start coming in. Rather, you actually go and look for something else to do because you haven't got enough contentment in the present moment. One of the most effective ways of developing this happiness in the present moment is just to wait. In other words, don't do anything. Just wait for a little while. And the present moment, lo and behold, becomes happy. Just give it time. Just put the cup down. It takes a little bit of time for the cup to become still. That's that simile I've been giving. If life is like a journey, meditation is stopping, becoming still for a few moments. Life is a journey, always going on to the next thing, and please don't go on to the next stage of meditation, or on to walking, or on to eating, or on to sleeping. Going on to the next thing is dwelling in the future, and that's usually how we live our lives. Another thing to do next. No wonder you get stressed. You never have any rest at all. Now you come along this journey, and there's a stone bench. I think I gave this seminar on a first night. You come across this stone bench. It's not comfortable, but it's good enough to sit down on. This present moment, when you first come to it, it's not comfortable. However, it's good enough to stay on. So you sit down on that bench, you stay in this present moment, and it's uncomfortable, it's bumpy, and it's cold. But something happens. The longer you sit on the stone bench, the more even it becomes, the bumps even out. And the hardness disappears and it becomes like a mattress. It becomes like seven mattresses.
and like a waterbed, it becomes warm, and you can lean back upon it, and it's just so comfortable. The longer you stay on it, the more comfortable it becomes. That's what the present moment is like. When you first stay in the present moment, it's not comfortable, because you haven't got enough stillness yet. The stillness generates the energy, little by little, which creates a sense of comfort and ease and joy. So sometimes it needs patience. Stay in the present moment or stay in the silence, even stay in the breath long enough, not moving and not doing anything. And because of the stillness, the energy starts to flow where it should belong, into the mind, not into the doer. And the thing becomes brighter. The clump of bamboo looks more beautiful. The carpet looks exquisite. And the present moment, wow, what a wonderful place to hang out. That's the best way. A little bit of patience. And allow the present moment to turn into something nice. The other way is a bit of loving kindness again. That similar I gave of the young man and the frog, who was a princess, was spelled under it by Mara. And all you need to do is to kiss the frog. And the frog is this beautiful, wonderful princess. We'll keep you happy forever and ever, John. And also pay all your bills so you don't have to go to work anymore. And of course, that's just a metaphor, not a real princess. You kiss this present moment, which is a frog of a moment. You know, it's just ugly and warty and just, what do I want to kiss that frog for? So you stay in the present moment, you give it a kiss of loving kindness. And the present moment turns into this wonderful, blissful princess vagina, which will keep you happy and pay all your spiritual bills for the rest of your life. So it's kissing the frog. Okay. So it's time now for the interviews for those people who want to have an interview. And I've got some nice, I'm sorry, Sister Mudita, I got your name wrong. So I'm getting old. Sister Naroda, Sister Mudita, I think I got your name crossed off. Then Sua D, Dania, Cheng, Chelpo, Peter, Lindsay, Chris, John, Tom. Ross got his name crossed off. And the other guys this afternoon. It's on the board there. If you don't want an interview, please cross your name off. If you want an interview, just no need to put a tick next to your name. Just leave it blank. And the interview room is next to the laundry. So that's why I call it brainwashing. I can put your brain in the washing machine and give it a good wash. That's where the interviews are. So if you're not having an interview, have a nice meditation. See if you can investigate what I've just been talking about. What is this doing? When I stop doing the doing, now, is it just like what Ajahn Brahm said, putting the cup down? Yeah, it moves a lot first of all. But wait. And see if it becomes still. Experiment to see what I said, whether it works, because that's important. That's where you have the experiential part, the insight part of the part. Okay, so happy non-doing. Ah, what a lot of frogs.